Battle 06, Independence, Part 2. We started planning the job that night. Of course, my initial instinct was to go that night, but Zoner and I both knew that wouldn't be a good idea. Undertaking such an operation hastily is a great way to get killed, and if I had managed to forget that, Zoner would have reminded me. We've worked together too long to let ourselves fall into traps as obvious as that. About midnight, we realized two things. One, we were very hungry. Two, we didn't feel like cooking. Faced with those circumstances, there were really only two things to do in Worcester, and since we didn't feel like dealing with the crowd at Denny's, we piled into the Lincoln and went to the Kenmore Diner instead. The Kenmore opens at 11 p.m., yes, you read that right, and specializes in, well, diner food. They're not the world's best burgers, but they're pretty good, and the home fries are outstanding. I did the driving. I was quiet on the way back to the house, lost in thought, half listening to Zoner and Sakura chatting. Most of my attention was turned inward. As we pulled into the driveway, the headlights slashed across the front of the house. I didn't know it at the time, but Zoner saw something move on the front steps. The first hint I had that something was off was when Fury crowded into Zoner's lap in the passenger seat, looking in the same direction, taking in big whiffs of air. He didn't seem upset, though, just interested, which kept me from getting antsy. Fury has a pretty reliable nose for trouble. "Griff," Zoner whispered, and the tone of his voice snapped me the rest of the way out of my reverie. "What?" I replied, suddenly alert. "Somebody on the front steps," Zoner said. "Light 'em up," I said, and Zoner put the spotlight next to his quarterlight into action. A moment later, the beam flicked on. He trained it across the front of the house, pinning the front door and steps in the beam. Sure enough, there was somebody there. It looked like whoever it was had been lying down on the wide top step and had sat up when we drove in. That was the movement Zoner saw. An arm came up to shield a pair of eyes from the glare, and then a voice came to us, sleep-blurred and annoyed. "Turn out that flaming light, will ya? What are you trying to do, give me a migraine?" Zoner didn't recognize the voice, but I did. I shut off the car and climbed out. Zoner, Sakura, and Fury all piled out as well, and we made our way to the front door. The light above the door must have burned out, because all we had to go by was the light of the moon and the street lamp across the street at St. Spiridon's. That was enough to tell that my instinct about the voice had been right, though. The owner of the irritated voice was a rather rumpled Asian girl of about Sakura's age, who'd been sleeping on the step under a yellow raincoat with a small duffel bag for a pillow. She had her dark hair chopped into a kind of punk pompadour effect, and big safety visor sunglasses pushed up on her forehead. "About time you guys got home," she groused as she got up, put her coat back on, and picked up her bag. "I've been out here for hours." She gave me an annoyed look. "You could at least leave the garage unlocked. I'm lucky it hasn't rained." "You're lucky we weren't out of town," I replied. Of all the things I hadn't expected to be doing tonight, high on the list would have been talking with a tousled, tired-looking, somewhat grubby girl named Jubilation Lee. And the strangest thing about it all was that she looked scared. I had always thought Jubilee, as she prefers to be known, wasn't scared of anything. "What are you doing here?" I asked her. "Where's Logan?" Even as I asked it, I realized I knew the answer. It tied in too neatly with what Lethbridge Stewart had told me earlier in the day. I just hadn't put it together. "I don't know," she replied miserably. "That's why I came to you." My heart sank. Oh, no. I unlocked the front door, took a step inside, and disarmed the security system, mostly for an excuse to take a moment and think. I might as well have saved myself the trouble and let Zoner do it, because all I could come up with was, "Come on in. When's the last time you ate?" She thought about that for a moment as she kicked off her shoes in the foyer, then said, "I don't know. Friday, maybe. No, I had some popcorn on the bus from Newark. Day before yesterday." "I'll get you something to eat, then," I said, and headed for the kitchen. "Come on," said Sakura, leading the way to her room. "You can use the shower and borrow some of my clothes. I'm Sakura Kasugano, by the way. Griffin-sensei's Eldritch car. Jubilee mustered a smile and told Sakura her name as they went around the corner toward the bedroom Sakura had staked out for herself. At the back of my head, I had the odd feeling that I might have just witnessed one of those Liddy meets Hunt moments, two vergences in the Force coming together that should never have been allowed to touch, but I put it out of my head and got to work. Fury went into the den, paced around in a circle, then flumped down in his favorite spot by the end of the couch with an audible harumph. All this was too much of a disruption to the routine of his house for him to take with good grace. While I got some of the big russets out from under the sink, washed them, and started chopping them for home fries, I thought about my old friend Logan. I first met Logan when I was 13, on my first trip with Rose to Japan, where I was to learn to handle myself abroad and defend myself against sudden ambushes by spending the summer touring the country alone and being randomly attacked by ninja. It was a pain, but I could handle a sneak attack now, and it did wonders for my ability to swear in Japanese. Anyway, I was getting my gaijin ass kicked in a noodle shop in Osaka when one of the guys trying his best to skewer me knocked over this little hairy guy's table. The little hairy guy didn't appreciate that, and in expressing his displeasure, he made one hell of a mess. Then he bought me some squid. Rose turned up for one of her periodic spot checks while we were eating and didn't seem very pleased since, A, I was supposed to handle the ninja on my own, and B, she apparently knew Logan and didn't like him. The feeling seemed to be mutual. She backed off a little bit when she discovered that the ninja involved in this altercation hadn't been part of the Ibuki clan, with whom Rose's arrangement to help with my training had been, and that these had, in fact, really been trying to kill me. But she still didn't like Logan. That was all right with me. She was welcome to her opinion. I, on the other hand, liked him quite a bit. I hung out with him for the rest of the summer, traveling all over Japan, Okinawa, and, officially only South Korea, learning far more than Rose ever thought I would, and in some respects more than she ever hoped I would, but that's another story, and getting into all manner of trouble. After a while, the Ibuki didn't need to bother me anymore. They could see I was getting quite enough practice without their help, so they switched to observing and providing backup where needed. You may have noticed that there isn't a ninja crime syndicate in Japan called the Order of the Emerald Dawn anymore. That's because of Logan and me, that summer. At the end of the summer, I went back to Maine, and Logan went wherever he damn well pleased. We meet up every few months to eat teppanyaki, talk about what we've been up to since last time, and, if we can spare the time and have enough open space, do a little sparring. Logan likes to project a tough guy image and pretend he's too gruff and nasty to bother with friends, but the truth is, he's a huge softy. For the last year or so, he's had his wing over Jubilee, a runaway from a California orphanage who'd been living in a shopping mall for months when he found her, or maybe she found him. It's hard to say who's adopted whom in that relationship. Which is why it was so alarming that she'd turned up on my doorstep without him. The last I knew, they were in Arizona, hiking the mountains around Flagstaff. I knew, though, that Logan did have a job. He just didn't wander around the world as the whim took him all the time, just most of the time. The rest of the time, he was a top-level agent for the Canadian Security and Intelligence Service, their equivalent of a 00-level agent in the British Secret Intelligence Service. He spent most of his time roaming around as he saw fit, because the missions he pulled were so dangerous, he spent all but about a month a year on leave. It was a reasonably short step from that knowledge, coupled with what the Brigadier had told me, to the cold feeling in my stomach. Of course, I could be wrong. Jubilee would presumably know if he'd been on a job when she lost track of him. I could get her to sort out the details after she'd had a chance to eat, and to sleep on something softer and warmer than our front stoop. Sakura came back a few minutes later, while I was heating up the deep fryer and Zonar was hunting for that pound of ground beef we knew was somewhere in the freezer, to report that our guest had been shown the shower, a sweatshirt and jeans had been placed at her disposal, and the clothes she'd arrived in were in the washer, but we'd probably better consider just burning them. "Thanks for taking care of her," I said. She grinned. "Part of the job, right, Sensei? I'm kind of like a shrine maiden." Zoner failed to suppress a snort and then ostentatiously busied himself with the freezer. Sakura sighed, rolling her eyes, and went to see if we had any ice cream in the big chest freezer in the garage, since none was to be found in the kitchen. There was, and she also found the meat we were looking for. Jubilee looked more comfortable once she was scrubbed and into fresh clothes, and the food improved her outlook still more. She told us what she knew, which wasn't a lot. She and Logan had been in Calgary, getting the oil changed in the old Winnebago they haul around in, when the call came in from his boss in Ottawa that SIS had a job for him. Before he'd even finished gassing up the Winnebago, a bunch of guys had jumped them. This, as I could testify, having traveled with Logan for part of a summer and intermittently since then, was no trivial task to undertake. If there is a man anywhere in the world harder to bring down in an ambush than Logan, I don't know his name. But, and Jubilee found this especially upsetting, these people had seemed to know exactly what they needed to do to drop him, and they had done it with machine-like precision. In less than 5 minutes, they'd packed him into a van and driven away, leaving Jubilee stunned on the gas station forecourt. She was at a loss to explain why they hadn't killed her. "Can you describe the people who did it?" Zoner asked. "Were they wearing uniforms?" She nodded. "Yeah, but I didn't recognize them. They looked like commandos of some kind, but their outfits weren't black. They were kind of a dark purplish red. They had those sweaters, you know, with the cloth patches, and pants with a lot of pockets, and berets, except for their leader." Zoner glanced across at me, and I knew he could see on my face that I'd had the same thought as he had. "What was different about him?" I asked. "Her," Jubilee corrected me. "It was a woman. Tall, dark hair. Would have been pretty if she wasn't so mean-looking. Her uniform was different. She had one of those jackets with the buttons up both sides of the front, and a hat like a cop's, only it was red like the uniforms, and the thing on the front wasn't a shield." "Was it a skull with a pair of wings?" asked Zoner. "Yeah," said Jubilee. "How'd you know?" He looked across the table at me, and at the same time we both said, "Laura Roxanne." "You know her?" "I think so," Zoner said. "Did she have glasses and a scar on her face here?" He drew a line with his finger down the middle of his left cheek and under the edge of his jawbone. Suddenly I felt cold. I hadn't noticed that Laura had a scar like that on her face the one time I'd seen her, but I knew someone else who did. "Son of a bitch," I muttered. "What?" asked Zoner, Sakura, and Jubilee all at once. "Nothing," I said, too quickly. None of them looked fooled, but none of them pressed it either. Jubilee was all for saddling up the horses and riding off to Logan's rescue right then and there, but between the relief of having found us home, the shower, and the food, the last few days of short naps under lousy sleeping conditions were catching up with her. After the second time she almost nodded off where she sat, I packed her off to one of the guest bedrooms, the only one left now that Sakura had staked her claim to the one in front. So here I was, 2 days later, parachuting into the middle of nowhere in the middle of the night, and Sakura was with me. I had all I could do to convince Jubilee not to come too, but she was smart enough to know that, even though she and Logan had their Batman and Robin thing going on, she didn't have the fighting chops to jump into the middle of a Shadaloo secret base. Not yet, anyway. That didn't stop her from insisting on shotgun aboard the Prince, though, and I was sure that if we needed backup, she'd appoint herself Zoner's bazooka reloader or some damn thing. On the plus side, Zoner had come through as usual. I landed bang on target, right on the wide sandy beach at the edge of a remote little body of water called Alkali Lake. Not to be confused, as Zoner and I nearly had, with the one in British Columbia. That would have been embarrassing. Didn't even get my Corcorans wet as I touched down, collapsed my canopy, then shrugged out of the harness and started balling the whole rig up so I could hide it. As I did, I turned and scanned the beach. It was very dark, no moon, only starlight. But I should have been able to see Sakura sorting out her own gear, even if, like me, she was dressed from neck to toe in black. Instead, there was nothing but the dim, pale crescent of the beach and the deep darkness of the water. I felt a momentary stab of panic. Had she fallen short of the beach and into the lake? If so, weighed down by jump boots and gear, she might well drown before she could get her life preserver inflated. We'd gone over the drill a million times, but even a quick study like Sakura only picks up so much in 2 days. Damn it. I'd tried to talk her out of coming along, but once that girl gets an idea into her head, you might as well be talking to a cinder block. At the very least, I should have insisted that we jump tandem, even if that would have complicated the landing. First things first, I wasn't doing her any good standing around in the middle of the beach. I ran to the brush at the beach's inland edge, knelt down among the evergreen bushes, and then keyed my radio. "Sakura," I whispered. Her quiet, muffled voice came back at once.
"Where are you?"
I sagged slightly with relief.
"I was about to ask you the same thing."
"I caught a gust and overshot the beach,"
she said.
"I'm not far off, though. I can smell the lake."
The lake did indeed have a faint but evident pungency, probably where it got its name. There's hard water, and then there's water so hard you can smell it.
"Are you okay?"
"Yeah, I'm fine. I missed the trees. Just figuring out where I am now."
"Okay, just like we planned it then."
We'd gone over CSIS's map of the area dozens of times on the kitchen table, planning rendezvous points, fallback points, entrance and exit routes. Sakura had taken to it all with slightly unnerving glee, as if being a commando might just be even cooler than being a martial artist.
"Roger that,"
she said.
"You at RV-1.
There was a soft click as she switched off her set to prolong the battery life. I did the same, stashed my shoot rig in the brush, looked around to get my bearings, and then headed for the rendezvous. I got there, to the edge of a small brook, before Sakura, probably because I had an easier time orienting myself. Now I had a small problem. On the one hand, I didn't want to be noticed by a passing patrol, should there happen to be any. SIS's satellite scans hadn't indicated any activity to speak of on the surface, but the way my luck had been going lately, all that meant was that Shadaloo knew their satellite windows and timed their patrols accordingly. On the other hand, if I hid too well, Sakura might not be able to find me, which would sort of nullify the whole point of the exercise. I ended up sort of standing around next to the brook, trying to stay in a spot where I could duck quickly into the underbrush if necessary, feeling a bit like I was waiting for a bus. If waiting for a bus involved keeping one's every nerve tense for the slightest sound or movement. After a couple of moments, I heard someone slipping up behind me. Too stealthy to be one of Shadaloo's jackbooted clowns, but not stealthy enough to escape my notice, I figured it had to be Sakura. I mean, who else was going to be sneaking around this deserted lakeshore in the middle of the night? I was just about to turn around and acknowledge her when she got an arm around my neck and kicked my feet neatly out from under me, toppling me backward. It was a well-executed move, but it irritated me a little. This certainly wasn't the time or place for horseplay, however technically competent. I twisted, grabbed the arm around my neck, and applied my considerably greater mass. I was still on my way down. There wasn't really any way of preventing that. But now, to her audible surprise, I was taking her with me. We hit the ground with rather more noise than I generally care to make when I'm infiltrating a vicious criminal syndicate's hidden stronghold. There followed a brief struggle in which it slowly dawned on me that, unless I had accidentally fallen asleep for a few years while waiting, this wasn't Sakura I was dealing with. My assailant was a woman, a grown one, and one who learned to fight in a completely different manner. She tried a number of dirty tricks as we scuffled around in the bushes, but I was ready for all of them and managed to avoid getting too badly damaged. Whoever she was, I didn't think she was a Shadaloo guard. They had no need to be stealthy, we were a zillion miles from anywhere. A Shadaloo guard would just have put her gun on me, and this woman did have a gun, I could feel it banging around on its sling as we fought, and done whatever came next. She might be one of the special operatives I had heard Bison kept around, like the Brigadier said SIS thought Cammy had been. But in that case, why didn't she raise the alarm as soon as I'd thwarted her first attempt to grab me? She was being just as quiet as I was. It was a weirdly silent little wrestling match. That didn't make sense if she was a Shadaloo op. So maybe she was an intruder too? While I was reaching that conclusion, she took advantage of my momentary distraction to gain the upper hand. She got me onto my back, knelt over me, and reared back a bit. In the faint starlight, I saw something glint and knew more from instinct than solid evidence that she'd drawn a knife. That wasn't anything I was interested in sticking around for, no pun intended. So I got ready to shift her by whatever means necessary. The next few seconds looked like getting very violent for a moment there, and then... In retrospect, I'm not entirely sure how the next part went. I think we recognized each other somehow. radar, ESP, pheromones, at the same instant. The next thing I knew, the knife lay discarded off to one side, and I wasn't being attacked so much as molested. That was nice, if unexpected, and, under the circumstances, a bit surreal. Of course, that was the point at which Sakura finally turned up. Apparently she misinterpreted what was going on, little wonder, really, or possibly she simply took exception to it anyway. Either way, she announced her arrival by launching a kick that my erstwhile attacker barely avoided, nearly starting another fight. This was all getting quite out of hand, and the really frustrating part was that I couldn't just yell at everyone to quit it for a second. In the end, I managed to make an irritated sort of noise that I think got the point across. They both stopped, eyed each other, and then turned toward me.
"What the hell are you doing here?"
my former assailant and I hissed simultaneously. Sakura looked from one of us to the other and back, then whispered,
"You know her, Sensei?"
The other woman looked bemused. I wouldn't have been able to tell, in the dark and with her face smudged with camouflage paint, except that I did know her. Quite well, in fact.
"Sensei?" she said.
I made a noise in my throat. This wasn't really the place or time for introductions. But then gestured as politely as I could and muttered with only mild sarcasm,
"Fine. Baroness, this is my apprentice, Sakura Kasugano. Sakura, meet Anastasia Sergeyevna Onatop, Baroness de Cobray."
"You have an apprentice?" the Baroness inquired archly.
"What's so funny about that?" I wondered, a trifle indignantly.
"You told me once you would never take a student," she said.
"You told me once you would never leave Destro's side, but I don't see him here," I shot back.
"Touché,"
the Baroness replied, a tad frostily.
"Look, can we do this later?" I asked. "We're exposed out here, and I have places to be."
Anna retrieved her knife, put it away, and led the way across the shallow brook and into the woods, making a follow-me gesture as she went. Sakura glanced at me. I shrugged and followed, and she came after, as quietly as she could.
"We can talk if we keep it quiet," said Anna as we moved deeper into the woods. "I've been watching this facility for days. Shadaloo doesn't patrol this sector. We're not within their active perimeter yet."
We hiked through the woods for the better part of a half hour before Anna waved us to a halt in a small clearing. We sat down on rocks and, through some kind of silent consensus, started checking over our gear.
"The Shadaloo outer perimeter is just over the next ridge," Anna told us. "I believe I've identified a path through their patrol zones that will get us to a possible entrance point to the facility itself."
Sakura said nothing, instead eyeing the equipment the Baroness was double-checking. Then, in a low voice, she said,
"You didn't tell me you knew any dominatrixes, Sensei."
I suppressed a laugh. The Baroness made a low growl and asked,
"Why does everyone make that assumption?"
"Maybe it's the spike-heeled jackboots," I speculated, "or the black leather bodysuit, or the whip."
"It was a gift from a friend, and it is a very useful tool," she said defensively. "No one thinks Indiana Jones is a dominatrix."
"Anna, Indy doesn't wear a leather catsuit and call himself the Baroness."
"Thank God," Sakura muttered. "I am a Baroness," Anna protested. "Dr. Jones is not a state."
"You have a point," I conceded, "of a sort. And you're not really a Baroness."
"Of course I am."
"Anna," I said indulgently, "you convinced the Prince of Borokovia to ennoble you at gunpoint."
"A simple misunderstanding," she said stuffily.
"Right." I scratched my head. "So, what are you doing here?"
"Seeking the secret of Shadaloo's dark power," she said lightly.
"You?" "I'm just looking for someone," I said. "Say, you wouldn't be planning to use that dark power for evil, would you?" Anna spread a hand on her upper chest.
"Me?
Surely not. Do I look like the kind of girl who would do a thing like that?" I don't think you want me to answer that, Baroness, I told her after a pause. She folded her arms.
Do-gooder.
That's me. I eyed her. I notice you're not wearing the snakehead logo thing. Gone freelance?
In a manner of speaking, why? Are you hiring?
Well, it depends, I said reasonably. Are you still a vicious, amoral terrorist without a shred of remorse or human decency?
Oh, please, she said dismissively. You will grant that I've always had a shred of human decency, or have you forgotten Malta?
I considered that, nodded. Okay, I'll stipulate to that. Anna smiled her I've-got-you-figured smile and added,
And if I know you, you are going to all this trouble for the sake of a woman.
That's true. And if I know you, you're going to all this trouble because the danger helps you forget that you still haven't found a meaningful direction for your life. She narrowed her eyes at me.
You are an annoyingly perceptive man. Have I told you that?
It seems to me that was why you dumped me, I noted. The second time. Lara, I recalled, had really not approved of the Baroness. But then, I think you were only really drawn to me in the first place because I was the first guy you really got to know who didn't wear a mask 24/7.
Possible.
Speaking of which, how is Destro? I asked, retying my boots.
I would not know, the Baroness replied coldly. Why don't you ask his secretary? I believe her name is Letitia.
Ouch. I finished one boot and started on the other. Well, I told you that guy was trouble.
You are an annoyingly perceptive man, she repeated. Have I told you that?
I sighed. Oh, you're not still mad at me about what I had to do to Xenia, are you?
It was a trifle unsporting, she said.
Unsporting? She was trying to kill me. I shook my head. Anyway, I didn't hurt her. Permanently. If anything, I like to think that I provided a valuable service. Anna eyed me skeptically.
Service?
Absolutely. If she's at all smart, she learned an important lesson about messing with forces you don't understand.
I'm sure that thought brings her great comfort, said the Baroness dryly.
I'll just be over here, missing all the subtext, Sakura put in. When you're older, Anna and I told her in unison. Then we glanced at each other, I shrugged, and she said, What about you? It took me a moment to track the question back to its source. Then I nodded toward the ridge and the facility beyond it and said, If she's alive, odds are she's in there somewhere.
Ah, said the Baroness, nodding. Now it all makes sense.
Rising, she adjusted her submachine gun sling so the swivels wouldn't clink and said,
Come on, then. Let's get closer. We must be very quiet now.
Closer inspection, once we'd topped the ridge and made our way down again, showed the bulk of the Shadaloo facility, at least the part of it that was visible from the outside, was a concrete arch dam at the end of the lake. This close, we could hear water flowing through the spillways. I wondered whether it had an operational hydroelectric plant. That would be handy for any secret goings-on Shadaloo might be getting up to inside. For a second, I entertained the notion that we were all on the wrong page here, and this was just a hydro dam belonging to some local power company, until closer inspection revealed the patrolling guards along the brow of the dam with their paramilitary uniforms and slung assault rifles.
This place kind of reminds me of Castle Destro, I murmured to Anna. I wonder if any of these guys are ex-Iron Grenadiers. It is entirely possible, she replied softly, studying the dam through a pair of night vision binoculars. Shadaloo has all but cornered the international terrorist job market these days.
We eluded the surface patrols and entered the dam through what had probably been some sort of secondary drain originally, but now seemed to have been converted into a freight tunnel. Inside, the concrete tunnels and clusters of overhead pipes seemed authentically industrial enough, but the whole place was too clean and clinical to really be an ordinary hydroelectric power plant. The All Hail Lord Bison posters and whatnot were also a pretty good giveaway.
The decor brings me back, the Baroness observed dryly.
Imagine if the commander had had the chops to back up his ambitions, I told her. That's Bison. She said, and I couldn't tell if she looked chilled or intrigued. The three of us moved warily through the dam's empty corridors. Some part of me was interested to note that Anna and I slipped easily back into the old rhythm, taking down a secure facility, commando fashion being something we had done before, and that Sakura fitted herself into the pattern with the same instinctive ease that she'd shown in picking up the framework of Shotokan Karate we were building her Lairdrit training on. We were alert, but not nervous, ready for action, but not looking for it, and we penetrated deep into the facility without detection. The place seemed to be lightly staffed at night, though there were signs everywhere of extensive occupation. The lab, because that, we concluded after encountering the first few rooms crammed with mysterious but obviously scientific equipment, was what it was, had obviously passed through a couple of different hands in its day. Some of the markings on the wall were clearly older than the others, and in a different stenciled typeface to boot. We didn't know what most of the legends on the walls and doors meant, since they were in some alphanumeric code for which we didn't have a key. But the corridors all seemed to be converging on a central location, and after a half hour or so of careful exploration, we found it. Sometimes, in my line of work, you enter a room that immediately screams, "Great evil committed while you wait." The central chamber of the Shadaloo Lab at Alkali Lake was one of those. It was sort of a combination mission control and mad scientist operating room, its walls covered with banks of computerized equipment and sporting a raised observation area off to one side.
"Ah," said Anna, slinging her MP5. "A computer. Now we're getting somewhere."
So saying, she crossed to the terminal that sat on a table up in the observation area and started negotiating with it. Sakura and I paced warily around the middle of the room as she did so, trying to watch all the entrances. That was easier said than done, because there was a very distracting obstacle in the center of the room. It was some kind of massive... what? Sarcophagus? Tank? Bit of both. It was transparent, like some sort of giant aquarium, maybe 6 feet high and across and 10 feet long, reinforced at the corners and edges with massive metal beams, open at the top. Along the long sides of the upper rim were rows of articulated metal arms that looked like they were designed to swing down into the tank at regularly spaced intervals. Sakura edged closer, intrigued, and examined the object at the end of one of the arms.
"Some kind of drill bit," she said,
then blinked, visibly a little freaked out, and said,
"And it's hollow."
I stepped up alongside her and looked. She was right. The arm ended in what looked for all the world like some kind of surgical-grade power drill, and there was a hole at the tip of the bit. A braided metal hose was connected to the back end of the drill, leading away into the guts of the equipment at the base of the far wall, and, I now saw, there was one for each of the arms. "Okay, I don't even want to know what they do in here," I said, putting my hand on Sakura's shoulder and steering her away from the machine. She kept staring in disturbed fascination at the drill thing for a few seconds, then tore her eyes away from it and swallowed.
"I've got something," said the Baroness. "This is the center of the facility. There's a detention area further along toward the face of the dam. That way," she noted, pointing to the door at the far side of the room. "The manifest lists 2 prisoners, both slated for transfer to central headquarters within the week. One level down, stairs are about 20 meters further along."
I restrained myself from asking, "What's that in real units?" There were times for teasing Europeans about the metric system and times for not, and we set off. I have rarely been gladder to leave a room and its contents behind. We had reached the door leading to the stairs when Sakura made her first real rookie mistake, a perfectly understandable one, not to be held against her, but a genuine schoolgirl error all the same.
"Where is everybody?" she wondered quietly,
and a moment later the stairway door opened from the other side and a patrolling guard in a Shadaloo uniform stepped out. I'm not sure which of us was more startled, me or him, as we suddenly found ourselves face to face across a distance of maybe 16 inches. His eyes got huge, and for a couple of seconds we just stared at each other in silence. And then Anna, being Anna, shot him. Her weapon was suppressed, so it only made a muffled sort of coughing noise, but something on the guard's uniform wasn't, and it made an ear-splitting wailing sound as he collapsed to the floor in a heap, which was, a moment later, drowned out by the overhead sirens going off.
"Oh, for fuck's sake, Anna!"
I grumbled, not that she could hear me over the din. Guards suddenly fluttered out of doors all up and down the corridor, looking confused and surprised, their uniforms and weapons in various states of disarray. Turning to the Baroness, I leaned close enough that she'd be able to hear me and yelled in her ear, "Why does it always have to be the shooty with you?"
"Well, you didn't seem inclined to do anything about him," she shot back, as it were.
"Go on, you're almost there. Down one level, take a left. First door on your right."
She yanked a miniature grenade from her web harness and thumbed its primer cap.
"I'll deal with these."
I flimbered it, then gave it up, grabbed Sakura's shoulder, she was still staring in shock at the dead guy, and hustled her through the door and onto the stairs. We reached the landing halfway down, and she grabbed at my arm and tugged for me to halt. I turned to her, noticing that all the color was gone from her face.
"This isn't really the time," I said, but before I could get further, she was babbling,
"Sensei, she killed that guy, just right in front of me, shot him, in the head."
I took both of her shoulders in my hands and looked her in the eye. "I know," I said. I should have expected she'd do something like that. It's the kind of person she is. And I'm sorry you had to see it. But it's done now, and you and I are in a lot of danger. I need you to focus. All right? I promise we can talk about it as much as you need to when we're safe, but right now you just have to hold it in and keep going. Can you do that? Seeing that she was still just staring at me in shock, I gave her a little shake and said in a harder voice, "Sakura, can you do that?" She blinked at the sound of her name.
"Yeah."
She took a deep breath and seemed to become a different person, the way she did sometimes when we were really in the dojo groove. She straightened her back, her eyes became flinty, and she snapped,
"Hi!"
and bowed from the shoulders up. "Good. Good soldier. You're doing great. I'm proud of you." I slapped her shoulders and propelled her onto the second half flight of stairs ahead of me. "Let's go." We hit the corridor onto the lower level expecting more guards, but found none. There were no alarms sounding down here, though the red lights were flashing in the upper corners of the halls. Above, very faintly through the layers of muffling concrete, we heard the sounds of gunfire and explosions.
"Will she be all right?"
Sakura asked me, her near breakdown apparently forgotten now that it had been overcome. That was more or less how she dealt with any obstacle, so it shouldn't have come as a surprise. "Sure she will. It's what she does." I looked up and down the corridor. "Take a left, first door on the right." I tried the door. It didn't work. I didn't have time for doors that didn't work, so I kicked it very hard. It was a surprisingly sturdy door. My hardest kick did it no harm at all. It was propelled clean out of its frame to smash down flat on the floor and slide some distance into the room, but it wasn't even dented. The room beyond was basically the panopticon of a cell block, complete with an upper-level perimeter catwalk, but instead of prison cells, it was ringed with what looked like upright metal coffins, the upper third or so of their lids made of glass. I ran to the middle of the room and turned around, scanning them with my eyes. Most of them were empty. Two of them weren't. I started toward one of them, not sure whether to be relieved or even more filled with dread, when a voice from above said sharply, "That's far enough." I looked up to see the upper-level catwalk filling with guards from a door leading out the far end of the room. In the center, standing with hands on hips while the guards filed out to either side of her until the catwalk was entirely full, was a slim young woman in a dark garment that looked like the love child of a leotard and a commando sweater. In the general shape of one, but made of the ribbed knit material one associates with the other, and with the same kind of shoulder and elbow patches. She had brown hair that was partly tucked under one of those canoe-shaped military caps, and she looked a bit smug. I turned to see another group of guards entering by the doorway we'd just used, with another girl, this one short-haired and blonde, in the same kind of uniform, apparently in charge of them. All told, there had to be 40 or 50 of them, all armed with submachine guns and pistols, plus the two unarmed commando girls, who I figured were the greater threat. I felt Sakura's shoulders settle against my back and turned my head to glance over my shoulder at her. "Sorry I got you into this," I muttered. She smirked slightly and tugged the knot of her hachimaki a little tighter. "It'll be good training," she replied, adopting her modified Shotokan starting stance. "Give it up, you two," the girl up on the catwalk demanded. "There's no possible way you can escape." "You've been kind enough to walk straight into our little trap. Don't ruin it now by forcing us to kill you," the blonde added. "Well, you wondered where everybody was," I told Sakura wryly. "I won't make that mistake again," she said ruefully. "You want to know what I think?" I asked the brunette. "What do you think?" she asked. "I think you don't really dare to have your men open fire in here," I said. "What with all these exposed pipes around that say things like gas and live steam," Sakura added, gesturing to the industrial walls above the detention chambers, "you didn't plan this very well." The brunette looked a little less smug and a lot more annoyed. "Weapons down, men," she ordered, and all the guards slung their weapons. Then she smiled darkly and said, "Beat them to death." The guards drew their truncheons and advanced. Fighting 50 or so trained security officers in a relatively confined space is an interesting way to spend an evening. I chain-lightninged the first 6 who came over the railing from the upper level, but after that I didn't have the time to aim or concentrate that much. Similarly, Sakura leveled at least as many, charging in from the lower level entryway with one of her modified Shotokan fireballs, but then she didn't have much room for that kind of stunt, and it became all about fists and feet and elbows and knees. This was the first time Sakura and I had been in a really serious fight together. Our adventures in Transbelvia had mainly consisted of a car chase, and her street brawl with the lowlives down by the bus station was more or less over by the time I got onto the scene. We had been training together for almost 7 weeks at that point, but never faced honest-to-God combat with nobody to depend on but each other before. This would be, I realized as it started, the real test of whether our partnership was going to work on the road, so to speak. She could take my direction in the dojo or out in the yard, but when the chips were down and everything depended on instantaneous reaction, on being able to read each other's silent cues and shape our courses accordingly, would we work as a team? In 3 words, oh, hell yeah. We didn't just click, we ignited. We were Fred and Ginger with fireball fists and eyes in the backs of each other's heads. We owned that room and every mook in it. My favorite move of the melee came when the two of the guards tried to flank me with their truncheons, and without saying a word, Sakura sprang onto my shoulders, vaulted my head like it was a pommel horse, and flattened them both at once with a V-leg kick, then circled around, flipped across my back, and took out the one to my right with a haymaker while I was busy banging another pair's heads together. It was startling when she did it, particularly the first bit, but amazingly elegant. One of those moments I wish I had on video, just so I could watch it again and again. The last guard bounced off my knee and went down in a clattering heap of riot armor and gear, and we were back to back again, looking around to see if anybody was getting up.
17, Sakura panted, catching her breath. Not bad for the new kid.
Not bad at all, I agreed. But you ought to count the one with the red tash. I just pushed him over. He was already out. Look sharp. Main act's about to begin. The brunette jumped down from the catwalk, landing nimbly between a couple of her crumpled subordinates, and looked around with an expression of vague disgust while her blonde counterpart moved to flank us from the other side.
"It's true what Master Bison says, Junie," she mused. "If you want something done right..."
"It's best to do it yourself, Julie," her colleague agreed. I was right. The two of them were a much greater threat than their 50 armed thugs had been. They were fast, they were agile, they were startlingly powerful, and, worst of all, they fought in a style I found eerily, dishearteningly familiar. They fought just like Cammy, and it was very distracting, particularly since she was right over there in display case number 12, seeming to watch the whole thing unfold with a glassy-eyed indifference. I hope that was just a side effect of whatever these things use to immobilize their occupants. Wool gathering in that fashion earned me an experience I'd been eager to avoid when I'd fought Cammy herself the previous year, and I have to report that my surmise at the time was right on the money. Getting your head crushed between somebody's knees, even a pretty girl's, and being flipped through 270 degrees onto the floor is pretty much not any fun at all. Sakura backflipped away from her own dance partner, catching her a nice clip under the chin in the process. Very guile, that maneuver, I wondered when she'd seen him do it, and landed next to me, putting a hand on my shoulder.
"Focus, sensei," she told me. "I don't want to end up in one of these boxes."
I glanced at her and grinned. "Let's switch it up a little," I told her, and when I sprang to my feet, we slapped hands, crossed paths, and engaged each other's adversaries. It wasn't really much of a change for us. The two girls fought like they'd been stamped from the same machine, which, I realized with a slight flesh crawl, they might have been. But it seemed to disconcert them. Their timing got a little ragged as one. I'd already forgotten which was which. Was the blonde one Junie? I guess it doesn't really matter. Tried to adjust to the sudden tripling of her opponent in size, while the other struggled equally to cope with Sakura's greater speed and her sheer ferocity. It was still a very hard fight, and we were winded, but Bison's dolls never quite regained the upper hand. The closest they came was when the one I was fighting back-tucked out of range of my slide kick, nearly into the middle of her partner's fight with Sakura, nearly tripped over one of the guards, rolled over him, and came up with his pistol in her hand, swinging it to aim at me.
"No, you don't,"
Sakura snapped, backhanding hers, Julie, I think, out of the way and charging. Rattled, Junie tried to spin around and got off one shot at her, missing well high and to the right, and then Sakura was coming up from below with all the power in her deceptively sturdy little body behind her fist and a very creditable pseudo-electric ki nimbus around it. Her cry of, "Shoken!" was almost drowned out by the crack of the energy discharge. The gun flew one way, the commando girl flew another, and nothing more was heard of either one that day.
"That's for nearly breaking Sensei's neck," Sakura informed her crumpled foe.
A metallic sound from behind her told us both that the one who was still standing had the same idea. We turned to see Julie picking up a cast-off submachine gun. "You really ought to put that down," I told her.
"Why?"
she replied, and then the Baroness stepped through the entry door and shot her in the thigh, fracturing her femur and causing her to drop the gun and fall to the floor with a yelp that was as much surprise as pain.
"Anna! God damn it! Can you not do that?"
I barked. "She's young," Anna replied, unconcerned. "She'll probably walk again. The upper level's clear for the moment. I suggest we make good our escape." I kicked the submachine gun away from the fallen, weeping girl and briefly felt bad about the whole thing. With her game face off, she looked like she should be cutting geometry class, not commanding thugs. "That's why you shouldn't point guns at strangers," I told her apologetically.
"Lord Bison will make you suffer for this," she said bitterly.
"Not if I see him first," I said with a confidence I didn't entirely feel, and went to see if I could figure out how to get the detention capsules open. That turned out to be no harder from the outside than opening a fridge, though Logan didn't react until I thought to press the green button labeled Release on the little control panel, then peel the two electrodes off his temples. The instant I did, his eyes snapped back into focus, and he said, "Thanks, kid. Who's your sidekick? She ain't bad." "We'll do introductions later," I said. "You okay?" He stepped gingerly out of the pod and flexed his arms thoughtfully. "Little stiff. Bored out of my flaming skull. These things keep you conscious. But nothing serious. Let's get the hell out of here." He angled his chin at the other occupied capsule. "I think I recognize somebody." I went to Cammy's pod, opened it, and repeated the procedure that had revived Logan. She, too, came back immediately from wherever the immobilizer had sent her, her eyes focusing on mine. But unlike Logan, fortunately, her first reaction was to kiss me.
"I'm sorry," she said. "I didn't have any choice. What are you doing here?"
It took me a second to work out what she was apologizing for. At first, I thought it was kissing me. And since there wasn't really time to get into that right now, I only said, "What do you think? I came looking for you. Can you walk? We've got to get gone, and fast." She stepped unsteadily out of the pod, took a couple of deep breaths, and then straightened up and said, "Just try and stop me.